Thanks for listening to the Frontiers podcast. If you have a moment before we start, please rate and follow this podcast. It makes a huge difference. The more of you that do this, the more people get to listen. And the more people that get to listen, the bigger platform I'm building for academics to share their research. Thanks so much. Hi there. You're listening to Frontiers, the podcast that explores cutting-edge research from the world's best scientists. I'm Ian Hallett, and in each episode, I interview professors, doctors, and research scientists who are leading authorities in technology, economics, business, politics, the environment, and sociology, so we can learn about the scientific breakthroughs that will redefine our world. Today, I'm delighted to share with you my conversation with Professor Anand Menon. Professor Menon is a professor of European politics and foreign affairs at King's College London, and he's also a director of a think tank, the UK in a Changing Europe. Our conversation obviously starts with Brexit, but we don't have a normal Brexit conversation. We go back to the history. Why did it happen? And what were the drivers for it? And we also explore whether public opinion has changed and whether or not it's been objectively a success or failure. What we then do is progress into a conversation around the dynamics of the UK and the EU relationship today. How is it working? Where's it going well? Where's it not going so well? And then finally, we talk about three external factors. So international organizations like NATO and the UN, world powers like USA and China, but also conflicts and whether or not they have the effect of bringing European Union and UK relationships closer or further apart. It's a really informative, interesting conversation, and I really hope you enjoy it. So now I'm going to hand over to Professor Anand Menon. Professor Menon, thanks for joining me today.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Let's talk about Brexit. So I want to go back to the history. So everyone knows about Brexit and everyone has an opinion, I think, on Brexit. But could we go back to the period before Brexit and what was leading up to it even being a question in the first place? So I'm interested in the history. Why did it happen? What were the drivers? What were the motivating factors?
God, this feels like ancient history, though it shouldn't. Lots of things. I mean, firstly, the UK had always been a pretty Eurosceptic country by European standards. And I think actually one of the structural reasons for that was that, unlike any other member state, for the UK, membership was pretty transactional. So if you think about it, just quickly, if you go through the original six member states, economic integration was a way of preventing war. For the southern European states that joined a bit later, economic integration was a way of reinforcing democracy after a period of dictatorship. For the countries from Eastern and Central Europe, economic integration was a way of solidifying their return to the West and their escape from the Soviet Union. For the United Kingdom, economic integration was about economic integration. Okay, there was no political overlay. So I think the glue that attached us to the European Union was always weaker than it was for other member states. So there's that background of Euroscepticism, which is important. And then there's a whole load of contingent factors, I think. A lot of people voted to leave in the referendum because they were dissatisfied either with the government or the state of politics or the state of the economy. There was contingency. I mean, we can wonder about, had the referendum not been held at the tail end of the Eurozone crisis, would the outcome have been different? Because the Eurozone crisis both allowed Eurosceptics to make that argument that we were shackled to an economic corpse and led to an increase in the number of Europeans coming here. It was a weird situation. The UK became a sort of labor market of last resort for a currency it wasn't in. Lots of southern Europeans were coming over here during the crisis. And of course, you had the migration crisis at the same time. So I think there's genuine Euroscepticism. There's a lot of other reasons that got thrown into the mix because that's what happens with referendums. And there was the contingency of the timing.
And what is it about the UK's psyche that's, you talk about fundamentally Eurosceptic in its nature. Mm-hmm. And what is it about people in the UK that make it like that? Is it just simply about the borders? We've got a large sea in between us and the European mainland. Is it as simple and as practical as that?
That's part of it, yeah. I mean, I think it's a mixture of history, geography, and politics. So geography, as you're saying, being an island makes a massive difference. psychologically. You know, I always remember when I was sort of in my teens and I went into railing, that you'd go to major European cities and you'd see road signs to cities in other countries. And it kind of freaks you out, doesn't it? That, you know, if you're in Geneva, there is a road sign sending you to a city in France. You know, if you go to Brussels, you can get the BBC on terrestrial TV. There's that kind of built-in multinationality, which we don't have being in Ireland. There's history. For most of the original founders of the European Union, the Second World War was their darkest hour. For us, it was one of our greatest triumphs. So psychologically, history worked very, very differently. And politics to an extent, that we have this very adversarial two-party system, which means that the sort of practice of negotiation, of compromise that characterizes the EU is something that we're slightly, I think, less comfortable with than some, if not all, of our European partners.
And what do you think about the method of making the decision as to whether or not the United Kingdom stays in the European Union or not? So a referendum. I mean, David Cameron was, I guess, fortunate with the Scottish referendum and ended up with the outcome that he was seeking. Yeah. Clearly didn't with this referendum compared to the outcome that he was seeking. What about that as a tool to solve these types of problems? What's your sense of whether this was the appropriate approach or not?
Well, let me start with Scotland, because that's interesting, isn't it? Because the Cameron government seemed to take a referendum where the gap between the two sides shrank from 25 points to 10 points in what he saw as the wrong direction as a vindication and a triumph. And I think it wasn't rocket science to detect that if you started off a bit closer and the same thing happened, then you'd be in trouble. So it was a weird set of lessons to learn from Scotland, and to run the same sort of Project Fierce sort of campaign was strange. I suppose what I'd say about a referendum as a tool is the referendum was what confirmed our membership. So it would have been very different to do it, to either to not have a referendum if you were making that decision, or to change the rules of the referendum. So for those people who said we should have had a supermajority, I suppose the answer is it would have looked a bit odd, as we didn't have a supermajority in 1975 to confirm membership. And, you know, I personally, this is a purely personal view, felt a bit uncomfortable at the idea that we'd start fiddling with the franchise for this particular vote, because that immediately smacks of illegitimacy for me. So it's, you know, I'm not for a moment arguing a referendum is an ideal tool. There was a very good report by the Public Affairs and Administration Committee of the House of Commons done on referendums and what they call bluff call referendums, i.e. politicians calling referendums to get a no to a question they want answered in the negative, and how dangerous they are. So far from ideal, but actually once you've decided that this is an issue you are going to have a serious conversation about, given 1975, it's quite hard to think of another way of doing it.
And what's public opinion today? So if we were to run a referendum today, would the outcome be the same?
I'd say two things. Quite possibly not, because public opinion seems to have shifted. And, you know, in parentheses, that's largely because of demographic churn rather than people changing their minds. That's to say, you know, younger voters who back Remain entering the electorate, older voters who back Leave perhaps no longer being part of the electorate, if I can put it that way. The most overwhelming thing, I think, though, is if we were to have a referendum, you would be met with an overwhelming scream of horror from both sides. Because, you know, increasingly what you find is, A, people don't care about Brexit all that much. The number of people who think Brexit is the top issue is vanishingly small now. And, you know, think back to January 2019, that number was in the 70%. So that's plummeted. And I think, you know, just some focus groups we did last year, the one thing that seemed to unite Leavers and Remainers was, can we please talk about something else now?
That's interesting. So I'll move on quite quickly then to the broader conversation, the consequences of it.
I could talk about Brexit till the chaos comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm sure lots of people could. So let's talk about its success and failure. So has it worked objectively? If we try to take a non-emotional, non-political perspective on this, compared to the outcomes that were promised, the negative effects that were raised, mm-hmm. Objectively, has it succeeded? Where has it succeeded? Where has it failed?
I mean, there are layers upon layers upon layers. So at its most simple level, if you were someone who was uncomfortable with the idea of membership in the European Union, for whatever reason, but for a lot of people it was because of the implications that had for national sovereignty, then yes, Brexit has worked. We've left. We're no longer subject in the same way to EU law. We're no longer forced to adopt legislation via majority voting that we might have disagreed with. So if those things worried you, mission accomplished. If you were the sort of person who said, actually, I find it a bit weird that we're a country who can't control who comes in via full sort of autonomy over our immigration policy, if that was what you were thinking about, yeah, Brexit has worked. If you're one of those people that said, I want to leave the European Union because I think it'll lead to a massive boost to GDP, then I think you were kidding yourselves then, and you've been proven to be wrong now. If you're one of those people, and let's be honest, a lot of Leave, for all the rhetoric that the Leave campaigners simply wanted control over immigration, the fact is a lot of Leave voters wanted a decrease in immigration. Those people are now going to be very, very disappointed indeed. So I think, you know, it depends what you believe in. And there are people who genuinely want to feel sovereign, regardless of the economic outcome. It's a perfectly legitimate point of view. There are people who want to control immigration, as in not reduce numbers, but have a decision about who comes here. And that, again, is a perfectly legitimate view. So it depends. You know, as ever, Brexit is a question of trade-offs. And to put it very, very simply, there was a trade-off between politics and economics. We can regain our sovereignty, but there will be an economic price to pay because this will make trade more difficult, more administratively difficult, and more costly.
And what about those people that were campaigning for Remain and they were talking about all of the reasons why you should not, why we should not do this? Have any of those concerns come to fore?
I mean, yeah, I think the economic case was overstated, but hey, in a campaign, you overstate, don't you? I think one of the interesting phenomena is the way that all that talk of a cliff edge by Remain supporters has kind of come back to haunt them. Because, you know, for leavers, it's quite interesting to say, the sky has not fallen in as you said it would, so you were wrong. Of course, the correct and subtle point is, no, the sky hasn't fallen in, but there has been a growing impact that is negative on the British economy. But of course, that sort of nuance is often lost in political debate. I was never massively taken by the argument of the Remain camp and some defenders of the European Union that the European Union had brought about peace in Western Europe. I think, you know, it is close and it made relations closer between the French and the Germans. I think NATO had as much part to play in preventing war in Europe as the European Union ever did. So, you know, you can treat some of these arguments with a degree of skepticism. But I think on the economic point, there is no doubt whatsoever that much of what the Remain camp was saying has proven to be right.
Okay, let's move the conversation up one level. You'll see I'm going to move this conversation up a level as we go through the stages.
I get rid of you.
Yeah. So we're going to go to the UK-EU relationship now, mm-hmm. and what the dynamic is, mm-hmm. as we stand here today. So what is it? Is it better? Is it worse? Is it the same as it was before Brexit? What's the current situation?
Well, it's clearly not the same as it was before Brexit in the simple sense that we are, you know, all the legal stuff has changed around membership and we don't get to spend as much time with our European colleagues. When I say we, I mean politicians don't spend as much time with their European colleagues as they used to. So actually, you know, it is one of the remarkable things I think about Brexit is, despite the fact that we have a war in the Middle East, we have a war in Europe, is our foreign minister has only attended the Foreign Affairs Committee once since we left the European Union. So there's a lack of contact. And I think that actually matters far more than I'd anticipated, actually. I think it's one of the more damaging legacies of the Trade and Cooperation Agreement. There's no doubt that relations have improved under Rishi Sunak. Rishi Sunak is far more of a pragmatist, I think, than his predecessors were. So since the Windsor framework came into operation, or was agreed in February of last year, then things have got better. We've joined Horizon. It appears that bilateral relations between British government ministers, both with the European Union and with individual member states, are functioning pretty well. But of course, there are limits to how closely we can work together. You know, the most obvious in the economic realm bleeds into things like foreign and security policy, because you still hear policymakers say we should be able to coordinate sanctions better and so on. So I think the fundamental point is, what membership of the European Union does to a certain extent is it domesticates international relations. So it makes our relationship with other member states feel more like domestic politics than but like diplomacy, because you're meeting, you know, you're an environment minister, you go meet your fellow environment ministers and you talk environment policy. That doesn't feel like international diplomacy. Whereas our relations with the European Union now are diplomatic. And that textural change, I think, is absolutely fundamental.
How so?
Well, because, you know, well, partly because of the administrative mechanisms we use to interact. So we interact with the European Union via the Foreign Office now. So ministry to ministry contacts, Treasury officials meeting other Treasury officials in ECOFIN, the Chancellor meeting finance ministers in ECOFIN, that no longer happens. So it's a more traditional foreign policy relationship than it was when we were inside the European Union. And I think that matters because you don't have the depth or the range or the full gamut of networks joining our countries that you used to have.
And is that something that was explicitly agreed? This is how the mode of operation would work, or is it defaulting to how the UK and other countries would operate with each other without being a part of a union?
I think it's just a function of the fact that the European Union is an utterly unique organisation that, as I says, domesticates the relations between sovereign states. And being outside it means your dealings with other sovereign states are traditional diplomatic relations with other sovereign states rather than the rather weird, ambiguous sort of relationships that you had within the European Union, which were part diplomatic, but part something else.
Okay, that's clear. Can we just go back to something you said a few minutes ago?
Mm-hmm.
And do a sidebar on the Windsor Framework.
Yeah.
Can you just explain what that is?
Well, the Windsor Framework, as part of the withdrawal agreement, Boris Johnson agreed the Northern Ireland Protocol. The Northern Ireland Protocol was a way of dealing with what people have called the Brexit trilemma, which is that you couldn't avoid a border in Northern Ireland and leave the single market and the customs union and have the whole of the UK leaving the European Union on the same terms, because the three were mutually incompatible. So what we decided to do was we left the single market and the customs union. We decided not to have a border on the island of Ireland, which both sides agreed on from the start. And as a result, Northern Ireland left the European Union on slightly different terms to the rest of the United Kingdom, because Northern Ireland, in order to avoid that border between North and South, remains bound by certain European Union rules automatically. From the start, the British government balked against the way that the European Union was implementing the protocol, and the European Union got ignored by what they saw as our non-compliance with an agreement we'd signed up to. And that led to serious tensions between the two sides. It made diplomatic relations very, very strained. The European Union was threatening to take us to court over what they saw as our failure to implement. And then Rishi Sunak and Ursula von der Leyen in February of last year came to an agreement on the Windsor Framework, whereby the way in which the protocol was implemented was slightly changed so as to make it less onerous, because unionist opinion in Northern Ireland hated the original way in which the protocol worked. They said they saw it as building a barrier between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And the Windsor Framework was a way of trying to mitigate the impact of the protocol on East-West trade. I hope that was clear.
It was clear enough. So let's talk about the work that you do as part of being a director of the UK and a Changing Europe. So one of the things I found very interesting on your website is the UK-EU Divergence Tracker.
Mm-hmm.
I thought those reports were very interesting. Can you just explain what that's all about and what you're finding? And we could then go on to other areas of research that you're doing as part of that, mm-hmm. as part of that initiative.
I mean, first and foremost, credit to Joël Roland, who is the researcher in our team who writes the Divergence Tracker and does such a, and has become a sort of leading authority now on UK-EU divergence. It's a spectacular piece of work that he produces. The Divergence Tracker came from early conversations we had about the fact that we really don't know the degree to which the UK and EU regulatory systems remain similar after Brexit or diverge. Now, the first thing to say is the Divergence Tracker is by no means exhaustive. what Joël does is he looks at highlights, you know, what are the main areas of convergence and divergence. But if we just stop for a minute and step back and think, why does this matter? It matters because at the heart of many of the arguments deployed by conservative Eurosceptics in the 20 years leading up to the referendum, overregulation, burdensome regulation, unnecessary regulation by the European Union was the heart of those arguments, which was membership of the European Union is preventing the UK economy from being as dynamic as it could be because those damn Europeans are obsessed with regulating everything. Okay, so this was central. And the paradox that Joël has discovered is that having left the European Union, we haven't really diverged that much. In fact, the majority of divergence that has taken place is not because our swashbuckling Brexit governments have said, we're going to burn all that regulation, that they've made it sound like they wanted to. They've never actually done it. It's because the European Union keeps regulating and we have to make some difficult decisions about whether we want to keep up or not. And that's interesting in its own right. It's important economically. It's interesting politically because of this key paradox. The coalition that those conservative Eurosceptics I was talking about needed to build in order to leave the European Union, the point of which was to deregulate, the nature of that coalition meant that having got the decision to leave the European Union, there was no consensus over the need to deregulate. So in a sense, the coalition needed to deliver Brexit made the ultimate point of Brexit for these people unachievable, because that Tory coalition includes a lot of people who don't want to see workers' rights scrapped. And so you end up in this weird situation that we've left, but we haven't got a clear agenda for what we want the British state to look like in regulatory terms, as opposed to what the European Union looks like.
And how different is EU regulation to American regulation or Australian regulation? I mean, the question in my mind when you were talking about that is, firstly, there's been decades of convergence between mm-hmm. the UK and the EU, because obviously mm-hmm. the UK was part of the EU. So it's going to take time for that to unwind. Yeah. But there must be a best way of doing this stuff. You know, talk about human rights, and you talk about welfare of people, and, you know, these different things are, there are ways to do this to ultimately achieve an outcome that most democratic governments would want to see. So is the EU and the way that they're taking things fundamentally at odds with what a UK citizen would want to see anyway?
I think the evidence from polling suggests that the preferences of UK citizens are closer to those of EU citizens when it comes to things like food regulation than to those of US citizens. There is no best way, because as everything, it depends what you mean by best. Mm. I mean, all regulatory decisions involve trade-offs between benefiting consumers, benefiting producers, public health versus economics. There are, you know, where you draw that line is a matter of legitimate debate. Even if you agree, even if the science agrees, and actually the science doesn't always agree. I mean, if you think back to the BSE crisis, one of the interesting things were British vets were finding things that were different to what European vets were finding. You know, the scientific arguments were different by country, which I think is fascinating. Okay. One of the paradoxes of Brexit was British public opinion was not that different to European public opinion when it came to things like that. But it's not just about scientific standards, is it? Because there's an economic argument here too, which is what businesses have kept saying, is the more we diverge from EU regulations, the harder it is for us, because we then have to comply with two sets of regulations, which adds costs. You know, if we have to register products to one set of standards here and a wholly different set of standards there, that is problematic. Now, this isn't about access to the single market, because you still have to go through checks anyway. It is about whether or not the rules are different and whether you have to, for instance, produce two product lines, one to comply with UK regulations, one to comply with EU regulations. It's more complicated than that as well, because the more we diverge from EU regulations, the more difficult it gets to trade between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, because Northern Ireland is sticking to EU rules. So you could imagine, for instance, one area that's been talked up as an area of divergence is gene editing technology. You could imagine stuff that is manufactured here using gene-edited technology that would not be legal for sale in Northern Ireland because they apply EU rules. So it's slightly messier because of Northern Ireland and the unique status of Northern Ireland, but there's an economic issue between GB and EU as well.
Okay, so if we bring all of this together, so we've got Brexit and the reasons for it, we've got the seemingly not a great deal of divergence from EU and UK regulations so far. If you take a typical person, UK citizen, what has been the practical difference for them as a result of this new relationship that we have with Europe?
Well, again, if you are a typical UK citizen who thinks actually I would rather see all decisions taken in London by a more sovereign parliament than we had when we were in the EU, there's a principled issue there that some people legitimately think is important. In practical terms, lots of things. We've seen higher food inflation than we would have seen had we been inside the European Union, simply because of costs, and that's likely to go higher still because the government's in the process of introducing some of the checks it has to have between us and the EU over the next 4 or 5 months. Travel has become more difficult. A lot of people have seen that. You have to wait to get your passport stamped. That, again, is going to get even more difficult in the autumn if the EU, as they've promised, bring in their new border scheme whereby people have to be fingerprinted. So it's harder to travel. People who have used to find it very easy to go and work in the European Union. There's been a lot of noise about creative industries, about musicians having restrictions on their ability to go and play in the European Union. They found it a lot harder because, of course, now there are visa rules. There are all sorts of restrictions on how long you can stay in the European Union. So there are a lot of practical things that have changed for a number of people, I think. And, you know, when you get to summer, people notice it at the border.
And businesses?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, businesses have noticed. The Brexit has particularly, as far as we can tell, impacted small businesses, because small businesses might have lower profit margins and also don't have a compliance team full of lawyers, accountants, and customs experts who can manage the paperwork of the border. But trading with the European Union has become more complicated, more expensive, and more slow, which has meant, as far as we can tell, that some small businesses have been driven out of the UK-EU trading market.
Okay, so I want to go up to these external forces that are bringing the UK and EU together or pushing them apart. So there's lots of things going on in the world at the moment. We have we have some wars, we have artificial intelligence that seems to be accelerating at massive pace, and a number of other geopolitical or global issues that actually require cooperation between close neighbours.
And
that's a geographic point, but also economic neighbours as well, of which the UK and EU are still strong economic parties. So I want to cover this in a different way. So I want to cover kind of the NATO-UN dynamic, and then I want to cover kind of world powers, USA, China. And then I'd like to, if we could, cover kind of the kind of conflicts that are happening. So how does the Ukraine-Russia conflict affect things? How does the Israel-Hamas conflict affect things, and so on? So I'm not sure how this conversation is going to play out, but I was thinking about it in those different dimensions. I may all end up converging into one discussion. So you talked earlier about actually NATO being perhaps one of the primary reasons why peace in Europe was sustained more than the European Union. So let's just talk about NATO and the UN today as two kind of international organizations that have specific objectives to bring alliances together. Is that now a bigger force on the convergence of UK-EU relationships? Is it different? Is a dynamic change? So what's happened with how that's playing out now?
I don't think the dynamics with it, I mean, within the UN, obviously, we're not part of the coordination system that the EU has, but we are a permanent member of the Security Council. So I think, in a sense, things continued as before. And because we're a permanent member of the Security Council, the EU will always talk to the UK ahead of major votes. So I don't think that's a massive difference. I think NATO as well, because of the war in Ukraine, cooperation between European allies has continued very, very well. Of course, there's a big storm cloud on the horizon when it comes to NATO, which is what happens if Donald Trump gets elected and he's made some noises that he might not reaffirm the importance of Article 5, which is the mutual assistance clause of the NATO treaty. So if an American president comes in and says, incidentally, if a European state is attacked, we won't help them, NATO is not worth the paper it's written on. So that might change in the future under a Trump presidency, but all the indications are that intra-European collaboration within NATO has continued very well. I mean, some people say even better than pre-Brexit, because that is the forum where we now meet with our European allies and discuss security issues as we're not part of EU meetings.
That was what's behind my question, actually. So have those international bodies increased their importance because the European body, with the UK part of it, is no longer there in the same way?
You know, one nice example of that is there's something called the European Political Community, which is an organization first proposed by President Macron in France, which brings together 40-odd European states. That is a very important forum for the United Kingdom because it gives Rishi Sunak an opportunity to meet other heads of state and government from European countries. And we don't have the same easy access to those people that we had as a member state. So yeah, I think other forums become more important because we've lost a key one.
And what about world powers? So we can pick anyone we want, but the USA is an obvious one. China is an obvious one. Previously, obviously, there'd be interaction between the USA and the UK directly, the USA and the EU directly. The UK not being part of the EU, by definition, is a lesser partner than it was before because it's not part of that big body. So has that dynamic changed at all?
Yeah, the dynamic changed profoundly. I mean, you know, we should say first and foremost that our military, our intelligence, our security relationship with the United States is unique and remains very, very close. But on some of the big geopolitical and politically and particularly economic issues of the day, the US deals with the EU. They're continental-sized economies. So despite all our aspirations to be a leading power when it comes to, say, regulation and AI, I think the things that will shift the dial in terms of global regulation are what the US and the EU say, and not what the UK says. So, you know, if you speak in private to British officials, they'll sometimes voice frustration about the fact that these discussions go on between the US and the EU, and we are not in the room. We are not informed. So those dynamics have changed quite profoundly, I think. I would suspect that the UK, the US, the White House spends a lot more time now discussing things with Berlin and Paris than it used to, and we're somewhat on the margin because we're not part of that European Union. So any question about, for instance, post-conflict reconstruction in Gaza, the EU will be a leading player because it's a far bigger economy with far more economic tools to deploy. So yeah, things have changed.
And where does that leave the UK in the future?
It leaves the UK as an influential medium power that doesn't have the added weight of being part of a continental-sized bloc. So, you know, this isn't a council of despair. I mean, Canada manages perfectly well not being in the United States, and they have a degree of diplomatic heft. But, there's no point trying to pretend that this hasn't impacted on us. Now, what some Brits will... There are two other things I would say. I mean, some British people say, okay, yeah, but we have an agility now that we didn't have inside the European Union. I'm skeptical because... You know, think back to Iraq. Member states were constrained in terms of what they said or did. They all took very different positions. I don't think the European Union constrained us in foreign policy terms. One of the things that I think has changed because of Brexit is successive governments have realized that they needed to be active on the world stage to show that Brexit hadn't meant that Britain didn't count anymore. So I think a lot of our activity on the world stage, whether it's things like the AUKUS treaty with the US and Australia, but it's things like our very noisy and very impressive support from Ukraine from the start, were partly motivated by a political incentive to show Brexit or not, the UK still matters. So in a sense, it's given us a political incentive to be more present when it comes to big foreign policy matters than might have been the case had we remained within the European Union.
And I mean, this is a bit of a fundamental question. Why does it matter to matter? So the, you know, as you mentioned, Canada is a fabulous country, seems to succeed and thrive perfectly well on its own. So why, what's this obsession with mattering and being important on the world stage? Why does the UK psyche need that?
Well, it's partly because the UK psyche needs it that it matters, because traditionally our politicians talking about punching above our weight, being influential, is something that has resonated quite well with the British public. But also because, you know, we do have genuine ways of influencing people, whether it's our military skills and expertise. Our military isn't as big as it used to be, but British Armed Forces are acknowledged as being amongst the best, so we're a reliable partner. and people want to work with us, which gives us a degree of influence, whether it is our soft power, whether it's things like the BBC or whatever it might be. Those are ways of influencing other countries, of striking closer relations with other countries, and that is good for the country to be able to do that. Now, it doesn't mean that you can parlay it immediately into economic benefits. You don't go up to another country and say, look, we've got the BBC World Service, will you give us a really good trade deal, please? But having that sort of international influence matters. And it matters not least because the more you can shape the world you're in, the more that world is likely to be one in which you're comfortable operating. And I think the battle for global leadership, for the maintenance of the liberal international order is arguably as important now as it has ever been.
And this then seems like, and I'm kind of probably maybe putting two and two together and getting the wrong answer with your response, that the motivation is fundamentally about, clearly, of, and this is an obvious statement, in whatever is in the best interest of the UK, the UK government will try to pursue. And the argument is that it's in the best interest of the UK to be able to influence other countries. And the reason why that's important is because of peace, trade, cooperation on other matters, that type of thing. Is that really what fundamentally is going on here?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, for every political decision, there are layers upon layers of meaning, okay? But I think if you want to step back and say, why does it matter? I think that's a pretty good summary. I think if we didn't have influence, someone else would have influence. And it's better to be out there shaping the world than not shaping the world.
And what about China? What's going on there?
Well,
with the relationship. So same question that I asked from the UK about China and the relationship between China and the EU, China and the UK, whether how that's different. I know it's a fundamentally different nature of relationship.
No, absolutely. But we've had a fundamental reassessment of our relationship with China since the sort of Cameron Osborne era when China was becoming one of our best friends. We've reassessed. One of the interesting things is how quickly political opinion within the Conservative Party has shifted on China. The China Research Group, you remember, under Theresa May, we changed our minds over Huawei's involvement in key infrastructure. So we're reassessing China now. We're more willing now to talk of China as a threat. We're more willing to call China out on human rights abuses. Partly, I suspect, that comes from pressure from the Americans. Because for the Americans, China is what foreign policy is all about now. Partly too, it has been a genuine shift. I mean, you know, there are lots of motivations behind the shift in our China policy. For some people, it's unfair economic competition. For some people, it's human rights. For some people, it's fear of Chinese technological domination in the future. There are lots of different opinions, even within the Conservative Party, about this. But there has been a shift, and it feels like a fairly permanent shift, given the mood in Parliament about China now. And again, you know, let's not forget, we've acted in a way we should be proud of when it comes to, for instance, offering visas for people from Hong Kong to come here after the clampdown there.
And let's then go on to the conflicts that are currently happening. UK, Ukraine, Russia, Israel, Hamas. There seems to be a lot of collaboration and cooperation that's going on here, particularly, well, with both of them. Again, don't those types of things bring these countries together more than push them apart? There seems to be alignment behind what each of the countries believe is important and the support that's being given.
I think that's more true of Ukraine than it is of the Middle East, because even within the European Union, there is a whole spectrum of opinion on the Israel-Hamas conflict, ranging from European countries that were very, very early on were calling for a ceasefire, to others who are closer to our position. But on Ukraine, absolutely. Ukraine has helped, the UK and the EU have worked together very, very closely over Ukraine, whether it's over sanctions, whether it's over training. Again, it is different to if we were a member state. So for instance, to take one obvious example is the European Union is sending ammunition to Ukraine. But their scheme for purchasing large amounts of ammunition and sending it is open only to member states, because part of the rationale for the scheme is to put money into EU-based defence industries. And that is something we're excluded from by virtue of not being a member state. So at that intersection between security and economics, Brexit is causing real frictions. But on the sort of simple foreign policy coordination on sanctions type of discussion, then it is absolutely true that the UK and the EU have worked together very closely. In fact, you hear EU officials say, well, Ukraine shows that we don't need a formal security pact with the European Union because things are working just fine. It should be said that Ukraine is a very, very easy case. It's one on which it's easy to agree. You have open, brutal military aggression, unprovoked by a country that we considered a threat anyway since Salisbury, very, very clearly so. And if European states couldn't agree on Ukraine, then my God, we would have problems.
We would. Let's talk about the future. So where do you think this is heading? If you take a 10 to 20 year view of the dynamic between the UK, European Union, and considering all of the external things that are happening outside of those blocks, whether it be geopolitical or technological, societal, where do you see the future?
I think the big question, in a sense, the question around the UK-EU relationship is whether we've reached a stable equilibrium or not. I suspect the equilibrium is more stable than many people think, particularly when it comes to economics, simply because short of tinkering at the margins, so the sort of thing that the Labour Party is talking about, we're going to sign a veterinary agreement and things like that, which are important, but aren't game-changing. The big decision is, should we be in the single market or not? And I just don't see that being on the agenda in the foreseeable future. For all the fact that, there is broad consensus about the economic costs of Brexit, I think partly because of Brexit fatigue, I think partly because political priorities are such that it's hard to see a prime minister saying, I'm going to embark on a 10-year project to do this in the near future. I think the economic relationship isn't going to change that fundamentally over the next decade or so. What might change that? A Trump presidency. A Trump presidency might mean that we work together much, much more closely on security. I remain skeptical that a Trump presidency would mean that the European Union suddenly says, don't worry about our rules. You can have bits of the single market. We'll do whatever it takes to work closely with you. I don't think that's the way it will happen. So I tend to think relative stability over the next decade will probably be the name of the game, though under a Labour government, relative stability with some add-ons like a security treaty, an SPS agreement and so on.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So obviously the UK election is going to be happening later on this year, and it looks like that Labour are going to win by some margin if you look at the opinion polls.
Mm-hmm.
Can we expect anything materially different from them that we're seeing with the current government?
Well, Labour have said that these side agreements on economics are things they will think about. Obviously, we have to see if the EU is willing to negotiate those things. And I think there is a sense still amongst some in Labour that the EU will play nicely with them just because they're not conservatives, and I'm not convinced that's true. So there'll be hard negotiations. They'll always, with the European Union, take longer than you think they should. And the other big thing is that the Labour Party have made clear they want to sign a sort of formal security arrangement with the European Union. And I think the European Union is open to that. I think it might address something I mentioned earlier, which is the lack of routine political contacts between the two sides. It will make it easier to meet our counterparts, to coordinate with them, to know what people are thinking. Again, it's not going to change things when it comes to the economics, but it might make it easier to work with the European Union on key foreign policy challenges.
Can you imagine other policies like that coming to force? So that one's orientated around security, but you could have one around the environment. You could have one around technology development. You could have one, if you really wanted to, around the economy. Is that the way that this relationship could develop through topic-based agreements?
Yes, though what I would caution is that the thing about foreign and defence policy in the European Union is that cooperation tends to take place largely between member states. And much of it isn't under the purview of the European Commission and so isn't bound by the same sort of dense network of rules and laws and procedures. And the closer you get to the heart of European integration, which is still economic, the more law-bound, the more bureaucratic, the more process-driven it becomes, and the harder it is. So we can be a third country and work closely with the European Union on some things when it comes to foreign policy. But of course, we know for a fact that you can't be in a bit of the single market. So it is the economic stuff is harder because of the nature of the European Union.
This has been a really fascinating and rich conversation. So I really appreciate you taking the time to do it. Do you have any final messages or topics that you'd like to cover before we finish?
I think just in terms of the narrow sense of UK-EU relations, what fascinates me is the fact that this issue won't go away. I think, you know, being on the doorstep of a continental-sized economy means that whether you like it or not, you're going to worry about what they do. You're going to worry about how they're regulating. And in a sense, a paradox might be that we have to spend more public policy time thinking explicitly about the European Union than we did when we were a member state, when stuff happened automatically. So, you know, perhaps the ultimate paradox is far from that referendum leading to the end of us banging on about Europe, we're now sort of condemned to bang on about it, I think, certainly amongst people interested in public policy, virtually forever.
Which is kind of ironic.
Yeah. It is indeed.
Where can we find out more about your work?
You can go to the website of UK and a Changing Europe, www.ukandeu.ac.uk, where, you know, we, the team, produce work, but we also work. Because UK and a Changing Europe is about making the findings of academic work more accessible to non-academics. So loads of academics, not just from the UK, but from around the world, we get them to summarize their research in a way that your ordinary reader can read once and understand. So go have a look at that, would be my advice.
And actually, I wouldn't mind going a bit deeper into that, if that's okay. What was the motivation behind doing that?
Well, I mean, the motivation came from the Research Council. We're funded by the Economic and Social Science Research Council, which is the National Research Council for the Social Science, government funded. And they set up a small organization before the 2014 Scottish referendum to provide impartial research-based information for people ahead of that referendum. That went pretty well. So in 2015, they thought we should do this for Europe. And they set up UK in a Changing Europe. We launched early in 2015. And our objective is impartially to simply say, this is what the research suggests. So we don't tell people Brexit is good, Brexit is bad, you should support it, you should not support it. What we will say, though, is what the evidence suggests is that Brexit has had a negative impact on the UK economy. The best economic studies come to these conclusions. Or, you know, so we do a bit of everything. We look at the state of devolution, the state of the UK economy, the state of UK politics, the state of UK-EU relations, various aspects of UK foreign policy, but the key, the sort of USP, is research-based work presented clearly. And I hope we achieve that. I'm not sure we all do.
You definitely did. I spent some time looking at it before interview, and as part of my preparation for it, I found it to be fascinating. And something that I think is really needed is I've noticed since having a leg in academia through a PhD research program that I'm doing, I've noticed that a lot of great academic research just not get into the public sphere because it's quite difficult. It's difficult to digest.
Yeah.
And that was the main motivation behind doing this podcast, actually, was to bring academic thinking to people that wouldn't ordinarily engage in it because either they don't think to engage into it or it's not that accessible to them.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, there's clearly some stuff that is difficult. I mean, Stephen Hawking's book is difficult to read because, you know, it's mind-bending, isn't it? And actually, but I don't think that should be true of the social sciences to the same extent. It might be that the methods are very technical and very complicated, and God knows there's an awful lot of maths in contemporary social science, but I still think when you come to your conclusions, you should be able to spell it out in an 800-word blog so that your average non-specialist reader can say, oh, that's interesting, that their research suggests this or that or the other. And that's what we aspire to do. And we aspire to make that available, not just to the general public, but to policymakers here and abroad, to civil servants, businesses. And so I confess, I love my job and I find it incredibly rewarding because when it works, it is incredibly satisfying.
Absolutely. Well, for now, Professor Mennell, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks ever so much for having me on.
Thank you so much for listening. To support this podcast, please follow it on whatever platform you're using. It makes a huge difference. Thank you again. Hope to see you next time.